It's a great pleasure to welcome to this conversation Sid Choraria. This is a conversation for the Zurich Project podcast, and I very much look forward to hosting you, Sid, in Zurich in 2021 at the Zurich Project. Sid, as I'm sure most of you know, is an investor focused on wonderful businesses at wonderful prices in Asian markets, including India, China, Japan, Australia, and ASEAN. Asian markets are inefficient and less competitive relative to developed markets and provide a rich and growing fertile fishing ground for global value investors. We're going to cover a few different topics today, Sid. One thing that I think you'll mention as well is in 2013, you gained the attention of Warren Buffett with a letter and investment write-up on a 125-year-old wide-mouth Japanese company. So I won't go too far into the details because I think you will address that. And maybe we will just start with your investment process. Could you please describe it for us?
Yeah, sure. Thank you, John. Can you hear me? You can hear me clearly, right?
Yes.
Excellent. Well, thank you, John, for having me for this podcast session. I would start off by saying that I'm a big believer of inversion, as taught by Charlie Munger. And so inversion as an active manager, my philosophy is to go where the fish are. So before I dive into the process, you think about the Asia backdrop, there's really a multi-decade opportunity in Asia. There's a large pond and it's growing. What do I mean by that? When you think about some of the countries, let's take China, for example. The GDP has grown in the last 20 years from 1 trillion to about 14 trillion. That's a 14 bagger. Market cap currently about 8 to 10 trillion. It's gone up almost 10 times. Retail participation is quite high, 80%. Of the domestic markets are dominated by retail, making it an inefficient market. Next, India, which is where I'm from, it's gone, from about 500 billion GDP about 20 years ago to now 3 trillion. The market cap, so that's about an 8-bagger. The market cap now, approximately about 2 trillion. You consider the GDP per capita, which is very, very low in India. It's lower than some, amazingly, it's lower than many of the countries around Asia has significantly lagged China. And so that's really low-hanging fruit, which really, bodes well from a long-term perspective. And then you think about the retail participation in India is very low. You have a young population of over 700 million or 800 million under the age of 35. So there has to be many Indian companies that are winners amongst this backdrop. Now, next, you look at Japan. This has been less a GDP growth story. It was 5 trillion 10 years ago. It's, or longer, and it's still there. But my focus, I fish in growing ponds in this particular market, Japanese products that sell very well to the Asian consumer outside of Japan, century-old businesses, cash cows. We'll discuss Kobayashi, as you pointed out. Again, the markets here are very inefficient because they're dominated by retail as well as they don't truly understand the international expansion opportunity. And then the Asian backdrop, you have Southeast Asia, you have Indonesia, you have Vietnam, Thailand, Malaysia, Singapore, some of the ASEAN countries. That GDP has gone from 600 billion on to 3 trillion. The region has about 600 million people. So put that those buckets together. Asia has also half the world's population, more than half the world's listed companies are in Asia. And I can go on and on, but this is what I truly believe, a multi-decade opportunity in Asia, large and growing ponds. And if you're inward, so you got to go where the fish are. In this bucket, I also have many of the best global companies is significant in Asia, whether you look at Starbucks, Nike, Pepsi, the fashion the best fashion brands, again, heavily reliant on Asia. You know, if you compare this to some of the other countries, say in Europe, let's start with UK, just about 3 trillion GDP. Germany is about 4 trillion. France is 2.9. Now, they were around that size 10 years ago as well, you know, and they've seen at best flat to low single digit growths. And, you know, if I was a betting man 10 to 20 years from now, you know, we'd be looking at a starkly different type of, you know, proportion. Well, Asia is going to rise in that mix in the world GDP. And so you want to fish where the fish are, John. I think that's very important. Now, what makes this even more compelling is that many of these markets that I discussed are hugely inefficient, some more inefficient than others. But many of these markets are dominated by speculators instead of investors. You know, as you know, in the book Margin of Safety, you know, Seth Klarman discusses investing versus speculation. You know, in your interview recently with the legendary Howard Marks, you know, he discusses, you know, what value, the core of value investing really is, you know, investing versus speculation. And these markets that I mentioned to you, which is a multi-decade opportunity, which is a large and growing pond, have a lot of speculators instead of investors. And that bodes really well for a diligent long-term investor. Yet, this type of backdrop is complex for foreign investors. You really need the local know-how. You need the networks on the ground. You need to know who the people are. You need to understand the regulatory environment, the political environment, et cetera. And so that makes it very important to have local know-how. As you know, John, you've read my bio. I've, you know, I grew up in India, but I've been trained outside. And then, you know, I've spent the bulk of my professional career, about 15 years in Asia, predominantly in Hong Kong and Singapore. Over the last 10 years or so, I've met over 400 companies in the region and have experienced firsthand the vibrancy and sort of the opportunity set. So bottom line, John, before the process, you know, fish where the fish are, fish with less competition, right? Now to discuss the process, John, as you explained previously, we've, you know, talked about this. I look for several things. The first aspect really is I look for a wonderful business. What do I mean by that? I need to have a clear understanding of the reinvestment opportunity, taking 3, 5, 10, 20 year view as to how big can this company grow to, right? That's very important. How big can this company grow to? Intangibles, I'm looking for companies that serve, you know, very, that have entrenched moats, that have intangible that earn more than their peers and understand why that does. You know, I'm looking for cash cows. And most importantly, I'm looking for this thing called predictability. It is a under studied kind of topic. You know, I think most people talk about it, but really there isn't literature as to how does one, you know, come up with companies that are more predictable than others. Now, this type of dynamic, these four characteristics I talked about, this is not easy to find. You know, I would say industry matters. For example, in India, which is a cricket-loving, it's a sport, cricket-loving sport. If you're the 20th best cricketer, you're just going to earn a lot more than the number one hockey-ranked, you know, player in India. Industry matters. And so the first step really is a wonderful business. The second step is looking for this outsider-type CEO, as I mentioned, wonderful incentives, capital allocation track record. What do I mean by this? We look at a compensation structure across different levels of the company and see how are employees incentivized. You know, is it on an operating income metric? Is it share price? Is it returns on capital? Is it revenue growth? Is it market share? And understand that because that tells you a lot about the culture. You look at share ownership across levels and how that's been distributed over long periods of time. As I explained previously in an interview, typically, you know, 10 to 30%, at least overall, is somewhat the sweet spot depending on the market capitalization of the company. I want to understand how employees become become really part owners in the company, or is this really a boss-like culture? In Asia, there tends to be this boss-like culture, and really you want to avoid that, you know, unless the boss is really, you know, an exceptional capital allocator, which there are a few examples of. Then really what I'm looking for is a 15 to 20 year track record. I'm not interested in a company that's just recently publicly listed. You've got 2-3 years of financials, and look, you know, it's probably in the difficult camp for me. So I'm looking at a 15 to 20 year track record of at least operating a financial track record. And then I'm looking to say, okay, a dollar of cash, how has this gone into different buckets? What is the reinvestment track record? How have they grown? What rates of returns versus the cost of capital? How has that spread changed over time? Is it increasing or is it decreasing? And this is a very quantitative approach. And second, okay, after this, what is the excess cash pile? Is it a lazy balance sheet? You know, are they now making changes, you know, paying out dividends and repurchases if there's no use for that excess cash pile, or are they just piling up cash? You know, acquisitions and divestitures, what types of companies have they bought? Is it a core versus non-core? What prices have you paid? What prices have they sold businesses and why? And then finally, also looking at capital raises, like why are they raising debt equity? You know, is it consistent with the overall common sense analysis of a thing? So bottom line, John, getting the people right in the second step is incredibly important. So once you do the wonderful business and the wonderful incentives, capital allocation, I would say that the third step is really the wonderful prize aspect. Here, I would say framework is extremely important. Human emotions get the best of us. That's why theory and practice is very, very different, right? You can study the theory, you can read Charlie Munger, you can understand the theory, it makes sense, it's very elegant, but practicing it is very different. And that's why I think it's very important to have a very clear framework. And so over the last, I would say, I worked very hard on this particular framework, John. I think about it in terms of a few variables, you know, at the core of which is this thing called predictability. So how predictable is it that the incremental returns on equity versus the cost of capital, right? Like how predictable is that spread? How predictable is the overall absolute and relative cash generation of the company? How predictable is the reinvestment opportunity? For some, it's easy to answer that question, those questions. For some, it's not. So the more predictable, all things being equal, the higher the margin of safety. You know, I think we've learned value investing in terms of assets and cash and balance sheets and, you know, low price to earnings ratios, and all that's fine, but minority investors don't really have access or influence over at least some of the assets or the cash, you know, unless you're an activist investor. And so, you know, in theory, that provides a margin of safety, but my own definition of margin of safety is really how predictable are some of those variables that I discussed. And I think the framework becomes very important. I also do think in terms of opportunity costs, interest rates versus what I'm getting, both absolute and relative. Is it growing? If I'm wrong, how wrong? And then the probabilities around that. I know there's a lot there, John, that we discussed. You know, the final point I'd like to make is that you have to be very patient, you know, but you have to act very firmly or aggressively when opportunities arise. So, you know, I've done a lot of work on many great businesses. Sometimes they're not at great prices, but I've identified step one and two, and then you have to wait. And this is important, but you have to act very firmly, aggressively when opportunities do arise. With that, John, you know, that's the explanation. I'd like to now pull up the Kobayashi case study to illustrate. So I'll show my screen here, and perhaps we can just discuss this very briefly before diving into the next question. So with that, John, You know, as you know, in 2013, I pitched IDEA, the Manual of Ideas, Kobayashi Pharmaceutical. Thank you for making that interview public. You know, the letter I sent to Mr. Buffett caught his attention, validating the write-up as well as the quality of the business. And on the right, as you can see, he said, it's a good company. We're looking for companies like Kobayashi that we can buy control of on a friendly basis. Keep your eyes open. Now, Kobayashi was in plain sight. It was a misunderstood business that was very scantily covered. It was a 125-year-old business that had one-page sell-side analyst from one sell-side analyst with no discussion on the moat, no discussion on capital allocation, and certainly no discussion on cash generation. The company was a wonderful business. You know, the high market shares, the brands, there's almost 40 brands with top domestic market shares, a big fish in a small pond strategy, a high percentage of revenue contribution from new products in a niche segment. And the second point is the incentive alignment. The company had a track record, or at least the compensation structure revealed that mid and senior management were aligned in terms of being compensated with their salaries with a metric that was capturing the spread on return on capital versus cost of capital, as well as operating profit metrics. Now the company has a track record. They've increased dividends 20 years. They've increased profits 20 years. They've repurchased stock during the financial crisis. They've divested loss-making divisions, and there was a ROI focus, and yet it was scantily covered. A $2.5 billion company sitting at that time in plain sight. At the time, it was available for 6 to 8x free cash flow, despite its wide moat. I forward my free cash flow estimates, limited institutional ownership, and just fast forwarding, you know, over the last 5 years. I would say as of yesterday, Kobayashi is at an all-time high. And I need to update this chart because the spread between the indices, the global indices and Asian indices, has only widened. John, the long answer to a short question, which I hope was helpful.
Absolutely, thank you so much. Extremely helpful, Sid. Could you go into more detail as to how one can identify other great businesses like Kobayashi and perhaps provide a few examples?
Yeah, John, absolutely. The first thing is that I've curated a list of 100 to 150 or so great businesses in Asia. My focus is very much on the undiscovered or lesser known widely names, right? You want to catch them early. It's kind of like hiring a great superstar. You want to hire them early. You don't want to hire a superstar because that's just, you're going to pay through your nose. And so like Kobayashi, like Nesco, both up, you know, about 4x since my first pitch, at the time, obscure, great businesses that met the three points that I discussed. Now, there are great businesses that are now well-known, right? Maotai, which I've, you know, discussed in a previous presentation, you know, Tencent, but they all had similar characteristics that I mentioned above, the three things: the wonderful business, good incentive capital allocation in their core businesses. And at some points, you know, only about, say, I would say 10 years ago, were really not very well-known businesses, but have gone on to become 100 baggers. And so, John, at the risk of repeating myself, I would say, you know, you're looking for products that are niches, products that don't change very much, at least at the core business. As you know, Mr. Buffett says, change is the enemy to at least investors, right? You're looking for a large runway and you're looking for that reinvestment opportunity. And then you want the core to be a cash cow and then make sure it's at the hand of a great outsider. As I explained, this is not easy. It takes time to identify such businesses. It takes local experiences. And I've curated a list of 100 or 150 somewhat less followed undiscovered names, some more discovered than others, but still have a long runway. So we can discuss a few names at a high level. Let's start with Japan, on the back of just Kobayashi. So the first company is a company called Hoya. Hoya is a company, it's a fairly, mid-large cap company, but I discuss it since, at least most of your viewers might not be familiar with Hoya. Since 1973, the company has never reported a loss. Hoya was founded 80 years ago, right? Much like Kobayashi, a very old, it's an old company. It's an exceptional capital allocator, probably amongst the best capital allocators in Japan. It's focused on niches with wide moats in the healthcare and mask blanks space. It has a Kobayashi-like philosophy, a big fish in a small pond. They have a 20-year track record of positive and growing free cash flow. They have a 28 to 30% return on unlevered return on equity. 83% of directors are independent and outside directors. They've paid 75% of free cash flow in dividends and repurchases over 20 years, and the company commits to returning excess cash on the balance sheet as a policy to return excess cash on the balance sheet straight back in the hands of shareholders. This is an example of an exceptional business, an exceptional capital allocator, an exceptional incentive alignment. And from time to time, the company, becomes a wonderful price. It is trading at a very good price, and I suspect, given what we're witnessing in the markets, John, folks should put this on the watch list. So Hoya is my first example. The second, just continuing on in Japan, Sumura. Sumura is a 127-year-old business. It is in the healthcare space. Japan has one of the biggest issues around demographics and aging. This company's products have an 80% share. So literally, they're the biggest share in its niche. That's unlikely to change over the next 20, 30 years. It hasn't changed for a long time. Now, the game changer with Sumura was that Ping An, which is a Chinese company, bought about 10% of its business about 2 years ago. And since then, the stock is lower. Now, there is a huge opportunity in China. And my sense is that even if you're wrong, the price is cheap. The price is low, and it compensates you for the potential growth option in some of these Asian markets with a very entrenched old business, which has disappointed investors for 5-10 years. But now there's this change coming, and I think that type of opportunity for a proven business with a very high share in Japan moving to China. The third Japanese business, we discussed, I've presented this, is a company called Pigeon, a 70-plus-year-old business. They are the leader in sort of, baby products. Babies are not going to change, their behavior 5 or 10 years from now, right? And Pigeon has many patents around their business. But the best part is it has a great capital allocation. They focus heavily on this spread between return on capital and cost of capital, which is rare anywhere in the world, but really rare in Japan. And, it's still only a $4 to $5 billion business. It has to be a bigger business over time. Now, it is not, I would say, the most undiscovered name, but certainly, I don't think it is a very discovered name either. Moving on to India, which is where I'm from, the first name I discussed is Marico. Marico, is very well known in India, and it's certainly, known in India. It's not undiscovered as such, but it's still only a $5 billion company. They make many products, but at least one of them, which is coconut hair oil. If any Indian really, will swear by it, right? Products that don't change, that haven't changed over the last 15, 20 years that are not going to change 20, 25 years from now. It's a household brand in India in many of the segments. They reach over 200 million Indian households. I think it's a company that would meet the Buffett test for wonderful business, wonderful capital allocation. The company has a 20-year record of positive revenue growth, net profits, operating and free cash, as well as good governance relatively, and has a high market share of 40 to 70% in niche segments. The next Indian company, I've mentioned Nesco a number of times. I think this is a very large margin of safety given its massive land bank, but it has run into a temporary problem because of COVID. And so watchers of MOI should be putting this on their watch list because you know, if this continues for a while, there's going to be no exhibitions and revenue could actually go down substantially. But look, there's a large margin of safety. As I explained before, you know, if you add up the cash and long-term investments on the balance sheet, the revenue of Nesco could be zero, and yet the company could pay for all its operating expenses for 5 to 7 years, perhaps higher. So it would meet the Buffett test, of course, quite small for him. But if Mr. Buffett was managing 200 million, I think this would certainly qualify. I'm doing a lot of work on many Chinese small mid caps that are between 1 to 5 billion that have met my tests of you know, one and two. I won't reveal the names for today. But what is amazing, John, in China is that the larger businesses like Moutai, like Hengrui, like Gri, like Liange, like Tencent, they're still growing 25% plus, which is incredible and amazing. And so I think there's lots of opportunity even in that space, the larger cap names in China. So I'll stop there, John. You know, I hope I've given a flavor of some of these names and some of the, and that's provided some insights on the process.
Absolutely. Sid, when you have two great businesses and both are seemingly available at similar valuations, how do you decide between them? Can you explain your process on the wonderful price?
Yeah, John, I think it centers around this thing called predictability. And so, you know, two great businesses, one could be, say, in Japan and one could be, say, in India, they have very different costs of capital. And really, that's a very important aspect to it, right? So if both are trading at 20 times earnings, hypothetically, or 5% cash flow yield, they're not the same because really you could, you know, you could, I mean, it depends whether it's dollar or in the local currency, but you really have to think about the price in relation to the opportunity cost available in that particular market. That's the first thing. So really, you know, opportunity cost is a very important thing. So the larger the spread relative to the local opportunity costs, you know, interest rates, et cetera, I think the more attractive that is. So the second part is the predictability, as I mentioned. So you analyze. I look at, as I said, I'm not a genius, so I need to look at a long-term track record of 15, 20 year. I'm just not interested in a company that just went IPO. I'm happy to miss those out, right? So I need a long-term economic cycle, and I want to scrutinize cash flow, returns on equity, and growth in different economic cycles. And I've done a lot of quantitative work around this, analyzing, you know, the thousands of companies across Asia. And so you come up with a metric, or what I would say is a framework that I've developed to think about predictability. And predictability meaning, John, you know, let's just take a very quick example. Let's just say Moutai, right? That's a company by now you're familiar with given the last presentation. And so if you look at when all the Baidu companies in China were reporting negative growth, which doesn't typically happen, but you know, I think it was in the 2013-14, there was an anti-corruption, but Moutai was still showing growth in that particular year, which was a terrible year, you know, and it was still showing somewhat flattish EPS growth in that particular year. So if you look just without looking at the name, if you looked at 20 years of data, and just said, these are the seven Baidu companies, you would have spotted that this one is more special than the others. And then it becomes a question of, okay, so Moutai and another company was trading both at 5% cash yields, or whatever metric you want to look at, right? Book or earnings yield. You know, I focus a lot more on cash generation. But you can look at earnings yield. I heard Howard Marks talk, fantastic talk with you about earnings yield. You can look at that. And then you have to say, well, they're not the same, even if the absolute figure looks like the same, because one has a different predictability trajectory, at least in the past. And the past is what we have to analyze, John. You know, it's much like hiring someone. You have a past CV track record and you can analyze that. It's very hard to say, well, you know, with very, very high in 3 years from now. But I think if you look at a long enough track record, you can say very, with a high degree of conviction that Moutai, well, certainly was more predictable than other companies. And all things being equal, two companies trading at the same sort of, you know. So now if you have two different great businesses, I think the definition of great varies, John. And I would say that even with two great businesses, you know, you could pick, you know, two great businesses in Asia, one maybe perhaps Kobayashi and Mariko. And then, you know, I would ask you, okay, what is the reinvestment opportunity? Okay, what is the local cost of capital? Then what is the predictability? Okay, what is the worst year? What is the best year? And then you have to come up with a sense as to kind of which one has been more predictable than the other. Of course, keeping in mind the reinvestment opportunity, and then have a framework around that. Without getting too much into the details, John, I think that what I'm saying is just because two companies trade at 20 times, it doesn't mean anything, because really they're trading in different markets, they have different types of investors, they have different track records over the past, they have different capital allocations, and you have to adjust all of that in the price, in the wonderful price that you look at. And so that's just a high level explanation, John. I'm happy to have a more detailed session on just this topic with a more formal presentation, which you know, I'd be happy to do at some point.
Well, that'll be terrific. Sid, how do you avoid landmines when investing in Asia, particularly on the corporate governance front, given recent examples in China?
Yeah, sure, John. Again, here you start with inversion. You study what has not worked. And this is a topic that has been near and dear to my heart. Because, you know, John, you can have a great 1 or 2 years, but if you bum out and you're down 50% in a cup because you know, if it's a market crisis, that's okay, so be it. But if it's a landmine, which happens to many, many great investors, that's typically because they, you know, have got entangled in some sort of accounting shenanigans. So if you look at, and without making particular comments on any particular companies, but just some public observations that have taken place, if you look at Luckin in China, well, when someone tells you it is China's Starbucks or China's Amazon or China's YouTube, to me, I pause right then and there, and I don't want to hear the thesis, because frankly, if you need to sell it using China's X or Y, rather than the data. So as I said, I look at the data, right? So the negative, Luckin, if you just looked at the data, it has negative cash flow, negative operating cash flow, negative free cash flow, raising capital, and it's competing against a very proven business, you know, Starbucks there. And the Chinese are aspirational. And so you follow the cash flow. What is interesting, John, I'll give you an anecdote. I attended a group meeting with the company about a year and a half or 2 years ago. At some point, I can't recall the timing of it, a company called TAL Education, T-A-L Education. Now, this is one of the leading education companies in China. You know, it's very fast growing. If you look at all the metrics, it meets, you know, it checks off all the right boxes. And I was like, wow, this is wonderful. And I was sitting there, and I was probably the only Indian guy sitting in a room full of Chinese. And I was like, yeah, I'm going to ask the dumbest question. And I did. And I asked the company, and I said, you know, without making any judgment, I said, I spotted that the market cap was 2 times the market cap of the next company, which was New Oriental, which is another leading education business, which is a great business, but they had half the operating cash flow. I mean, TEL Education had half the operating cash flow of New Oriental, not free cash flow, but operating cash flow, but 2x the market cap. And I was like, well, maybe the market really is inefficient. And so I asked them to explain what caused this. And there was not a clear answer. I dug deeper. I couldn't figure it out after the 1 hour conversation. And then we had some discussions on the balance sheet. There was a lot of investments on the balance sheet. And so I asked for a breakdown of that. I could not get it. When in doubt, pause or just move on. And that's exactly what I did, despite the great numbers. Well, interestingly, more recently, the company has publicly admitted that there was some accounting shenanigans around revenue, et cetera. I think Muddy Waters got involved also 2 years ago. And so I'm just giving you an anecdote. Really, you don't have to, without making a comment on TEL, you common sense, right? The other point I'd say is related parties. Related parties, when I see too many related party transactions, I swipe left. What do I mean by that? There's this explosive example, of course, in the last couple of years. There was this company called Hanergy in Hong Kong, which was at one point the guy was the richest guy in China, eclipsing even Alibaba. There's the company in Australia, ABC Learning. And I'm giving past case studies, John, of companies that have, got into related parties. The next observation I would have is if margins are too high, or the company is growing much faster than peers, you really want to understand why that is the case. And you really want to understand that over long periods of time. In Moutai's case, as I explained, it's really because it is the number one brand in China, and that's indisputable. And so you understand that. But as we know, this is going back 10 years ago, there was a company called Satyam Computer in India. Well, the margins were much higher than many other leading Indian IT companies, and Satyam was much smaller, and they weren't necessarily serving a niche space. So that could be explained. And so, I mean, there's obviously a lot more to that, and they also had a related party. So I would say, follow the cash flow, avoid related parties, avoid companies where margins are too high and you cannot explain it. And finally, three more points. The revenue recognition is important. Really, most of the trouble starts there. And if a company especially has an opaque business model, for example, there were some famous investors that got entangled in an Asian fraud called Sinoforest, right? It was very hard to understand how this company recognizes revenue. I think you just have to take it for what it's, what they report. And so that's important. And you want to avoid, I think, also very recent IPOs. At least in my experience, I've tended to get burnt there because typically, and that's not to say all IPOs. I mean, there's certainly some great ones, and Google had its IPOs probably an obvious no, that. But in my experience, recent IPOs, I like to swipe left. I mean, there are exceptions, but really the numbers typically are padded up a lot more, because the incentive alignment of bankers versus, And then the last point I would say, John, is acquisitions. When you see a company doing serial acquisitions, I usually swipe left. I would say the final points are if the company has a board of who's who, it is typically a red flag for me, because will they really spend the time to ask the tough questions? Probably not. And that's why in Hoya's case, I provided that example because, as I said, 86% or 80%, were independent, truly independent directors. And the auditor don't necessarily rely on them. So this is a topic near to my heart, John. And again, I could have a separate talk just on this topic if you wanted to.
And Sid, perhaps before we wrap it up, could you describe in more detail your thoughts on portfolio management?
Absolutely, John. So my goal is to populate the companies with pricing power, really wonderful businesses, but at discounted prices. I think it's very much possible in inefficient markets in Asia. Now to the core portfolio, I'm long biased. That's not to say I wouldn't short, you know, I would if the opportunities were really lining up, but really long biased, 8 to 15 great businesses across Asia. Larger ponds in China, India, and Japan, I would say those are the markets. I do find opportunities in South Asia and Australia. You know, I read your conversation with Monish Babra, you know, a recent interview with Mr. Babra, and he said, be a harsh grader of people. And so I would say be a harsh grader of businesses. So 8 to 15. But if you look at the blended portfolio outcome, typically the characteristics are what we discussed, the reinvestment opportunity, you know, I would call it like 15, 20% type growth. You know, if it's not growing, it better trade at 1x cash flow. High returns on unlevered equity. Again, as I said, it's a comparison to cost of capital. You adjust this for tangible cash, non-operating assets. And then I don't like debt in general. So at a blended level, if you look at the 8 to 15 businesses that I'd like to own, they tend to have these type of characteristics. Then I don't mind holding cash in lieu of great opportunities, but I have identified many cash-like alternative stocks, and I tend to increase my weighting there when you know, three things don't align. Now, in terms of geographies, you know, I don't like to focus only on one market because I've my experience suggests that typically there is you know, periods where really the three qualities cannot be met, and really that gives you an opportunity to be a little more agile than a single country portfolio. And you know, of course. You know, I do avoid customer concentration, supplier concentration, industries, you know, make sure that they have very different characteristics. There's a lot of thought that goes into that when adding stocks to the portfolio. And really, you want to, you know, once you've done that, John, you really want to hold the business for as long as possible. As I said, I typically don't short, but you know, that's not to say I wouldn't. You know, I'd be flexible, and sometimes there are good opportunities on that side. So I'll leave it there, John.
Well, Sid, this has been another terrific conversation. Thank you so much for sharing your insights into value investing and intelligent investing in Asia. It's always a great pleasure.
Thank you very much, John.
Goodbye for now.